We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Casillas. Captain Castanian, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Lee, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Captain Samantha Castanian, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, represent the appellant, Airman First Class Nicholas Casillas, in today's case. Chief Judge Olson, I'd like to respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. In October, this court decided United States versus Mendoza. Following Mendoza's logic, A1C Casillas' conviction must be set aside for at least 2 reasons. First, his conviction is unconstitutional. The definition of consent in Article 120 allows the fact finder to convict on uncharged theories of liability, which this court has held is a violation of the accused's due process rights. Second, his conviction, the government failed to prove the crime that it charged. In other words, his conviction was legally insufficient. By eliciting evidence that the named victim was sleeping or incapable of consenting, the government failed to prove that it was capable of consenting and did not consent.
Now, why is that the case? So in terms of Issue 3, we're looking at the question of whether there was legal sufficiency.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have to look at the evidence in light most favorable to the government. If we go through, why aren't we checking the boxes in terms of saying that the appellant penetrated the victim, that penetration occurred not only when the victim was asleep, but also when she had awakened. The victim did not give any consent throughout that time, before, during, or after. And the appellant did it to gratify his sexual desires. You were talking about the fact that the government, I think the word you use is listed other things having to do with non-consent, as the government would put it, during the time that she was sleeping. But why does that go to the narrow issue of legal sufficiency?
Because in this case, Your Honor, for two reasons, but factually, on pages 114 and 115 of the JA, testifies about what occurred and specifically says she awoke with A1C Casillas' penis inside of her. She froze. She did nothing. But the reason that she knew it was his penis is because he was taking it out. Effectively, the act was over in the moment that she was capable of consenting and did not consent.
Now, wait a minute, though. Isn't it penetration, no matter how slight? Are you saying an appellate court should look at it and say there's a distinction between 1 second, 30 seconds, 3 minutes? As long as there's penetration, no matter how slight that penetration might be, no matter how small a period of time that may occur, why isn't that legally sufficient?
For this specific case, Your Honor, the problem is that it's essentially equivalent to saying no and A1C Casillas complying with that. That's this case alone. There are other cases where the 3 minute...
The government says in its brief that individuals exist in a state of non-consent, and until such time as consent is given, in whatever form it may be given, that non-consent occurs. Why is the government mistaken? You seem to feel that that is an incorrect observation.
It is, Your Honor, and it kind of goes to the definition of consent itself. When we look at that lack of physical resistance or lack of verbal resistance does not constitute consent, but it also could be surrounding circumstances or information that indicates there is consent. In a long-term relationship...
How are you getting to consent if he inserted his penis, at the time she was asleep? She had no knowledge of what was going on.
That's critical, Your Honor, for the due process problem and the unconstitutional dynamic in this case.
Okay, let's set that aside for a minute. I'm focusing on, you're saying he would have assumed that there was consent. How possibly could he assume that there was consent?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because for the legal sufficiency, it's absolutely correct. Every favorable inference goes to the government. So in this case, I've testified that she was asleep. She cannot consent in that state. She cannot give consent in that state. And this court held in Mendoza that for without consent cases, which is what he's charged with, the government has to prove capable of consenting.
But counsel, did she not, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but did she not also testify that prior to her falling asleep, she had not consented, she did not, the trial counsel took her through, did you consent to him taking your pants off? No. Did you consent to him? No. So it was three no's. And so going back to the chief judge's question, if we take the premise that the government is putting forth that individuals exist in a state of non-consent, then where was their affirmative consent? Because what has happened, and as I recall, it was kind of this continuum in my mind, that in this instance, factually, prior to her falling asleep, there clearly was no consent. Then she fell asleep, and then she was awakened by him having penetrated her. So at what point then are you saying that she was, that somehow she gave consent?
It's not that she gave consent, Your Honor. It's that the actus reus was complete at the moment she was capable of giving consent. The factual, for legal sufficiency to take all of those facts as true, I'm going to. So she does not consent prior to falling asleep. She falls asleep, and then the moment that she is capable of consenting, and she says that she does not consent, the act is over because A1C Casillas is pulling his penis out of her vagina. And that's what's different about this case and difficult to really discuss the constitutional problem. It goes to during none of these times that the government points to for other circumstances for lack of consent. She's incapable of consenting, and that's the problem that comes through Mendoza with this case, is that if there's legal sufficiency in this case, there's never a reason for the government to charge a sleep case. This is a case where the victim woke up. There are cases where that would not happen, but in this case, when it woke up, she denied consenting, but A1C Casillas was pulling his penis out. This state of constant lack of consent also goes against the idea that there are other indicators for consent, especially in this case, and that might not be relevant for legal sufficiency, but it certainly is relevant for factual sufficiency. To the extent that this court finds legal sufficiency, A1C Casillas is entitled to a new factual sufficiency review, just like in United States versus Mendoza. And the reason for that is we can look at the Air Force Court's opinion and see that it's predicated on incapacity evidence, which is a different theory of liability than what he was charged with. When we look at the Air Force Court's opinion, they quote things like, she woke up to A1C Casillas' penis, meaning she's incapable prior to that, so consent cannot be given. The Air Force quote quotes, she was no longer responsive at some point. That's another incapacity factual matter. Quotes A1C Casillas by saying, his quotes of, she was out of it, you might not have been completely there, I had to wake her ass up, she was completely out of it. This is all capacity evidence. So even if this court finds legal sufficiency in this case has to be remanded for a new factual sufficiency for double check.
Why is that within the scope of the granted issue?
Your Honor, in light of Mendoza and what Mendoza did to proving lack of consent cases, the Air Force Court did not apply the correct law. In United States versus Sager, this court cites United States versus Peace and says that the Courts of Appeals for the Armed Forces factual sufficiency review must be based on a correct view of the law. The Air Force Court's application and analysis is not based on a correct view of the law, and A1C Casillas is entitled to that for double jeopardy protection, because if this court decided to remand for a rehearing, he might not be protected when he could have been and should have been under a new factual sufficiency review.
So why shouldn't the issue that was presented to us and that we granted on been, did the CCA conduct a proper factual sufficiency review rather than what we actually granted on, and that is the issue of whether there was legal sufficiency?
This court should go to the legal sufficiency issue, Your Honor. However, because of how significant Mendoza was, and this court recognized that in the Mendoza opinion about how significant the determination or the holding that to prove lack of consent, the government had to prove it was capable and did not consent. That holding radically changes the military justice system construct because we have, as seen in the JA and the cases that are cited within, CCAs or the courts of appeals have been using incompetency evidence to prove these crimes. This is the wrong theory of liability, and A1C Casillas is entitled to a new factual sufficiency review in light of...
Captain Castaigne, let me ask you this. When do you argue or say that the assault actually ended? The offense for which he's charged ended?
When she wakes up, essentially, Your Honor, because at that point he is removing his penis from her and she testifies to that.
But don't the facts suggest at that point that she is aware? Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor. She says that she wakes up with his penis inside of her and she does not consent. And at the same time, she says, I knew it was his penis because he was taking it out. And this is one moment of time. There is no other evidence in the record that provides additional information of what that means, how long it was, but she says...
And how long does it have to be? If she wakes up and he is still engaged in the act, I guess I still don't understand how you can posit that the offense stopped when she woke up, when in fact it's still going on.
Yes, Your Honor, that... For two reasons. This case is distinct because she wakes up and he's taking his penis out. There are certainly cases where that is not going to be the case.
So is it your position that at that point she was still incapable of consenting? Because I think the evidence, viewed in light most favorable to the government, is that she was aware and was able to consent and did not.
I would agree, Your Honor. Based on the evidence in light most favorable to the prosecution, she says that she is capable of consenting, and she does not consent. She freezes. But in that moment where she freezes, A1C Casillas is pulling his penis out. Compare this to a case where the victim is awake the entire time and consensual sex is occurring. She withdraws consent. For lack of a better word, A1C Casillas cannot just teleport himself out of her. There has to be a moment in time. And this fact pattern is unique because it involves incapacity evidence following Mendoza. If Mendoza is to stand for the principle that the government cannot argue uncharged theories of liability, the government should not be able to use the one moment where she's capable of consenting to prove this crime under these facts.
Why are you looking at this, and why are you saying this court should look at this as a video rather than as a snapshot? As a snapshot, we have your client penetrating a person who had never given any consent. Why isn't that legally sufficient as compared to your video analogy where, well, she came to, she woke up, she realized what was going on, and then at that point he was withdrawing his penis. Why is the video analogy better than the photo analogy?
The video analogy goes to the constitutional issue, and I want to talk about that briefly because it's important for framing the factual sufficiency problem in this case. The government charged without consent had to prove that it was capable and did not consent. Rather than doing that, the government elicited and focused on evidence that was asleep. And that is a different charge theory of liability.
When you say focused on, I mean, can't they make reference to the surrounding circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor.
But didn't they also argue basically what their theory was that she did not consent?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. In this case, the government focuses...
My reading of the record is wrong.
I would disagree with your reading of the record, Your Honor. It seems very much so that the government is arguing that you can consider how she described awakened, feeling Airman Casillas' penis in her private region. You have a witness that came up here and told you, I was asleep. A sleeping unconscious or incompetent person cannot consent. It's that argument and it's that focus on incompetency that makes the video analogy more apt because the government is able to circumvent the mens rea requirement. In this case, it's able to circumvent the voluntary intoxication defense or instruction that A1C Casillas would have received when there was a specific knowledge requirement involved. They're able to lower their burden of proof. The government points out on page 36 and 37 of their brief that they're always going to have to prove that A1C Casillas knew that he was asleep and that he wouldn't have gotten consent in that way. That's not true. Incompetency evidence negates the government's burden of proof. And second of all, that puts the burden on the accused to raise mistake of fact in the first place. So the government's method of prosecuting this case is the problem. And that's why the snapshot, looking at just the one moment of time, conflates the theories of liability. And again, even if this court finds that the conviction is legally sufficient, factual sufficiency, a new factual sufficiency review is appropriate because the CCAs did not rely on the correct law and they did not have the benefit of Mendoza. But even going to the other granted issues in this case, Your Honor, looking at the due process violation, the government certainly argued multiple theories of liability in this case that were uncharged. I've read some of them, but they include using A1C Casillas' statements again to say, quote, I had to wake her ass up.
Counsel, what do we make of the victim's testimony on JA-116 that she did not consent to the act?
For this case, Your Honor, it's relevant because she did not consent. That is relevant evidence to this case, but the problem is that with a mistake of fact, legal sufficiency analysis, that might not be enough. And that's, again, going to the problem of legal sufficiency is different than factual sufficiency, and he's entitled to a new factual sufficiency review. Legally sufficient, she did not consent. She said she didn't consent. She testified she did not consent, and we have that moment in time, but he's pulling out of her at that time, too.
Go ahead. Are you conceding that it is legally sufficient?
No, Your Honor, because of the actus reus temporal component in this case.
Okay.
Oh, I had forgotten my question. With regards to the capable consent, is it your position that the military judge needed to have made a finding of fact that she was capable of consent? Is that what you're looking for? Or is that what you want this court to, as part of our holding, to be?
Yes, Your Honor. This court should hold that there needed to be a capable of consenting portion. Your Honor, I see that my time's about to expire, but I'd like to expand.
Please continue.
Your Honor, specifically to your point, with Mendoza, the military judge needed to provide more information to the panel. So reading the elements and then reading the definition of consent parsed to what is applicable in this case. The military judge in this case already did not read subsection B, the one about fear and the other fraud theories. But in the first sentence, we always have competency, which this court seems to have approved of in Mendoza. So to clarify that, the military judge should have instructed as follows. To prove lack of consent, the government must prove the victim was capable of consenting and did not consent. Evidence has been introduced that the victim was incapable of consenting. If you find the victim was incapable of consenting, the government has failed to prove lack of consent. If you find the victim was capable of consenting, the government must still prove the victim did not consent. And that's in this case where there aren't multiple theories of liability charged, presented the fact finder. This court should tell military judges and instruct military judges on what needs to be read for the definition of consent, because the definition of consent always brings in these uncharged theories of liability, that's the underlying due process issue in this case. And for that reason, this court must set aside his conviction.
Chief Judge, could I put a question to the counsel? But you can answer it when you come back on for your second round. How about that? And my question is this. On the issue of the instruction, I'm not quite following how the failure to give an instruction can render a statute unconstitutionally applied, as applied to someone. You know, usually that's not the usual approach when you have an as-applied argument or an as-applied situation. Could you help me out when you come back on that question?
Yes, Your Honor. Would you prefer that?
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Castaneda. Captain Lee.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Kate Lee, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. The offense of sexual assault without consent is not a yardstick. It is a flexible tape measure designed to measure sexual assault in its various forms, including hybrid scenarios like this case. With that in mind, this court should affirm appellant's conviction and sentence for three reasons. First, because the statute unambiguously prohibits non-consensual sex, which is exactly what appellant was convicted of. Second, because any rational fact finder could find the continuous absence of consent from start to finish. And third, because a member's minimal secondhand exposure to a decades-old sex assault does not present a close call of implied bias.
Captain Lee, I'd like to turn your attention to page 39 of the government's initial brief, where the government states, the evidence presented at trial reflected the prosecution's theory that having sex with a sleeping person is one of several ways sexual assault could be perpetrated without consent. So the government is saying this was the prosecution's theory, which is in contravention of our holding in Mendoza, which came later. This is what was presented to the panel members. Why then shouldn't that give us great concern, consistent with the approach that Captain Castanian has laid out here, in terms of the government was seeking to prove an offense with which the accused was not charged?
Your Honor, I think our initial brief reflects the idea that the government may prove up an offense in different ways, using different circumstances. An accused may commit an offense in different ways. And, of course, prior to Mendoza, the definition of without consent suggests that perpetrating sexual assault on a person who's sleeping or under threat, those are means of committing the offense of sexual assault without consent. But even now in the post-Mendoza framework, if you look at the record, the government focused, yes, they did highlight evidence that she was asleep, but if you look at the trial counsel's argument and their evidence as a whole, they focus on lack of consent. So the evidence, to start with the evidence, the government's evidence showed that the victim, she testified that she did not consent before going to sleep, three no's, as Your Honor pointed out, and she also didn't want the accused to be there. She told one of their mutual friends that she wanted him to leave, which no reasonable person would interpret that as an invitation to later have sex with her in that very same apartment. Then there's also evidence that the appellant, as victim slept, promised their mutual friend, I'm not going to try anything unless she wants to, which tells us that he knew he needed her consent and that he didn't have it. And then there's, of course, the evidence that he began the sexual act as she slept and that she awoke to the sexual act. And regardless of whether he was pulling out or whether he was in there for 1 second, 30 seconds, 3 minutes, that is still criminal. Every single second of his penetration is criminal. And there's also...
So granted all those points, but still the government's brief is saying the prosecution's theory was something that we have said is an illegitimate, inappropriate approach for the government to take. So my question is, why isn't Captain Castanian correct then in terms of this creates grave problems in the legal sufficiency / factual sufficiency world where no aspersions being cast. The trial counsel, the government at that time, didn't have the benefit of Mendoza. The military judge didn't, and the CCA didn't. But why shouldn't this be sent back?
Your Honor, because legal sufficiency doesn't turn on what trial counsel's argument, whether or not that particular argument would have convinced a specific panel of their theory of the case. It turns on how the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, whether or not any rational fact finder could find every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
But I'm sorry, Captain, but I think that to follow on another way of kind of phrasing Chief's question, and that goes to the rational, to the fact finder, that are we clear or are we sure or do we have confidence that the fact finders did not convict him based upon the incapacity evidence as opposed to the without consent evidence. That was one of the concerns in Mendoza, that when you have, when you bring in the different theories and they become so blurred that you do not have confidence that the fact finders convicted and accused based upon the correct legal theory.
Your Honor, in this case, I think this case is different from Mendoza in that in Mendoza, this court expressed it was concerned that the prosecution relied merely on evidence of incapacity to prove the absence of consent. But that's not what happened in this case, and that's why we shouldn't have the same concerns, Your Honor, because the prosecution, though they, yes, though they highlighted sleep, they also brought in the fact that victim, both victim and an appellant had been drinking. But they also highlighted, first and foremost, her testimony that she said she never consented. That was the highlight of trial counsel's argument. She came up here and told you, I never told him he could pull down my pants. I never told him he could penetrate me. So they're clearly focused on consent, and that's evident from the rest of their argument, which addresses the defense's own strategy, which also focuses on proving either, you know, defending by showing either consent or reasonable mistake of fact as to consent. So it's clear from the record as a whole that everyone knew exactly the theory of liability that appellant was charged with and the theory under which he would be convicted, which is without consent.
Counsel, would this be a different case if the entire act had been completed while the victim was asleep?
Potentially, Your Honor, there are, and to address one of appellant's points about when would the government ever charge consent, there are scenarios where I think a sexual assault might be better charged as consent, and that, but it all depends on the surrounding circumstances. In this particular case, because she testified, I never consented before going to sleep. And there's also evidence that he knows he doesn't have her consent before she went to sleep. This might not be that case, but in a case where, for example, a victim is engaged in consensual sex with an appellant and then happens to fall asleep and the appellant continues on but does, the victim didn't want him to continue having sex with her as he slept. That might be a fact pattern where the government would prefer to charge sexual assault on a sleeping victim because there is evidence of consent, which sort of goes to a broader point about prosecutorial discretion, Your Honors. The government, I think appellant's argument presumes that when there is a statute, when there are overlapping criminal provisions, that the government is somehow beholden to prosecute an accused under the one with the more specific mens rea. Otherwise, we will be accused of circumventing mens rea requirements. But that's simply not the case, because the government should be prosecuting the crime that fit the facts of the offense. So when its evidence better fits one offense than the other, it's entirely within its discretion to prosecute under the one that it's confident it can prove.
Now, I'm a little bit concerned. I don't understand why your response to Judge Hardy's question wasn't yes, full stop. And you're talking about prosecutorial discretion and maybe a better way to approach it. If a victim is asleep at the time of the penetration and remains asleep upon the penetration ending, why isn't that clearly not a situation where it could have been charged as in this case it was charged?
Your Honor, why is that not a situation where it could be?
Correct. So in other words, why wouldn't it be charged as incapable of consenting? You seem to be saying, well, the government can choose what they have, prosecutorial discretion. It might be better to do it this way. Why isn't it a clear-cut example that Judge Hardy posed to you of incapable of consenting? It's not up to the government trial counsel to say, well, we prefer to go with a different theory here.
Well, Your Honor, I want to start by addressing the term incapable of consenting. The statute as it uses incapable of consenting, the subsections that criminalize sexual acts on a person who's incapable of consenting, it's a very limited category of incapacity. It's those who are incapable of consenting, that is, lack the capacity to consent by virtue of impairment or disability. So beyond that, I think to the extent that we're using incapable of consenting, that's a very limited category. And sleep falls under a different subsection. So it's not necessarily treated the same as incapacity under Article 120. To answer your question, Your Honor, I think it's because it's fact-dependent. Where, in this case, there, you know, if there's evidence that there wasn't consent, to go to the fact that people do not exist in a perpetual state of consent. Consent has to be given, not withheld. And so if someone hasn't given consent before they go to sleep, then they go to sleep non-consenting, and they remain non-consenting while they're asleep, and when they wake up, they will still be non-consenting, which is exactly what happened in this case, Your Honors. She went to sleep non-consenting. She remained non-consenting when the act began, and when she woke up because of the penetration, she was still non-consenting. And that is clearly the kind of conduct that Article 120 is intended to criminalize. Appellant's conduct in this case is clearly criminal, and he, from the evidence and the record, it's clear that he knew exactly how to defend against it. So for him to now claim that he didn't know, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
Let me ask a bit more of a specific question. Is it the government's position that for a sexual act that is committed on a person who is sleeping for the entire duration of the sexual act, that the government still has the authority to charge that under either B2A without consent or B2B, a sexual act committed upon a person who's asleep when the person committing the act knew or should have known that the person was asleep?
I think so, Your Honor, because, again, it goes to the surrounding circumstances, whether or not there's evidence that shows that the victim went to sleep non-consenting. It really depends on the evidence, and I think that's why Congress might have included this without consent provision, because Congress recognized, as this Court recognized in Rocha, that statutes need to be sufficiently broad to deal with unseen and unforetold variations in factual situations.
I mean, it seems like we have one situation where a person is asleep and the other one's broader, but is it the government's position that B2A and B2B overlap in that circumstance, or that crimes committed against victims who are asleep go under B2B and B2A is for the rest of the non-consent crime?
Your Honor, I think they do overlap to some extent because of hybrid scenarios like this case. There may be instances where charging a sexual assault as a sexual act on a sleeping person is appropriate. There may be instances where there's a combination of those facts, and to best capture the accused criminality in a scenario like this case, charging without consent ensures the government can argue the facts, since the definition of consent says a sleeping person cannot consent.
Well, post-Mendoza, does the government run the risk then of running into a due process problem where they charge a defendant with one theory of criminal liability, but they end up litigating the case on a different theory?
No, Your Honor, because the government cannot switch theories of liability when they have to prove up the elements of the charged offense. When we charge sexual assault without consent, we're always required to prove that the sexual act occurred and that it occurred without consent. And in some cases, we're required to disprove the defense of reasonable mistake of fact. At no point can the government prove up the case using elements from another theory of liability. And so in that sense, the government's never switching theories of liability. Just because there is factual overlap between the facts that could be used to prove one theory of liability versus the facts that could be used to prove another theory of liability doesn't mean that the government can suddenly switch theories at trial.
So that sounds exactly like the theory that the government put forward in Mendoza that the court rejected.
Your Honor, I think we maintain that factual overlap, I mean, there will be factual overlap in other scenarios. For example, our drug cases, our homicide cases, our assault statutes, those also involve various offenses where there could be factual overlap. Just because we charge something as simple assault doesn't mean we can turn around and argue that they're guilty because they committed aggravated assault. So that's the thrust of our position here, is that when we charge without consent, we have to prove up the elements of without consent. We're not proving up the elements of another offense. And I think that is, as a matter of law, that is what the government's burden is. And we're not lowering our burden in any way by charging a without consent offense. I think that presumes that without consent is somehow easier to prove than other sexual assault offenses, but that's simply not the case.
Doesn't it circumvent the mens rea requirement?
No, Your Honor. And to address that particular point, when there are overlapping criminal provisions like without consent or sexual assault on a sleeping victim, Nothing about due process or fair notice requires us to import the specific mens rea into the general intent provision. Those are separate crimes with separate elements, and proving the specific mens rea is not necessarily always harder than proving a general intent offense or disproving defenses to a general intent offense. For example, if an accused commits sexual assault on a victim who's completely asleep for the entire act, and it turns out that it was in a room with a CCTV camera that captured her lying there motionless while he assaulted her. In that case, even if there's no evidence of the accused's admissions, no testimony, nothing that he said, the government could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he knew or should have known that she was asleep. That might be an easier case to prove than, for example, a case where there maybe was a pre-existing relationship and, an encounter started out with consensual kissing, that the accused escalated into sex that the victim didn't want but didn't resist, didn't say no. In that case, disproving the reasonable mistake of fact as to consent and thereby proving the absence of consent could be harder than proving a specific mens rea in that CCTV footage scenario.
Counsel, may I ask a separate question? Suppose we agree with you that the evidence is legally sufficient. Appellant argues that we would still have to remand the case for a new factual sufficiency review, basically because the CCA may not have properly understood the governing rules before Mendoza was decided, and therefore not conducted a proper factual sufficiency review. What's the government's response to that?
We believe that remanding for new factual sufficiency is not necessary because if you look at the CCA's analysis, it is focused on consent. Although it brings in the other circumstances because that is evidence that came out at trial, its decision isn't based on incapacity whatsoever. It highlights the fact that she said she didn't consent, and it also notes that he knew she was awake. And that's also evidence that I wanted to highlight for this court is that the appellant said, I really thought you knew because you didn't say anything when you woke up. So he knew she was awake. He knew she hadn't said anything to indicate that she was okay with the penetration. And that in that sense, it proves both that he knew she was asleep at some point and woke up, and that by the time she woke up, he still didn't have her consent. So as far as the due process concerns for Mendoza, those don't really apply here because the government's evidence proves up both without consent, and we're not conceding that this is what happened, but to the extent there's any concern that the government's theory of liability also included sexual assault on a sleeping person, its evidence still proves up the elements of that offense as well. And so, Your Honor, we don't think remand for a new factual sufficiency review is necessary.
So let me correct a distinction I was making before in terms of sleeping and incapable of giving consent. Let's say, hypothetical, where an accused says to a victim, do you want to have sex? And she says, yes, just let me take this drug first. Drug renders her completely unconscious. The accused has sex with her and completes the act before the victim comes to. Is there one or more ways the government could charge that?
Well, I think under this court's framework in Mendoza, the way to charge that would be as incapable of consenting due to impairment by a drug. Barring any further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Lee.
This court should affirm appellant's conviction and sentence because Article 120 is constitutional on its face and as applied. Appellant's conviction is legally sufficient, and the military judge did not err in denying the challenge for cause.
Thank you. Captain Castanian, I believe you have a question posed to you by Judge Sparks.
Judge Sparks, the question that I believe you asked, and I want to make sure it's clear, is why does failure to give an instruction render the statute unconstitutional as applied? Is that accurate?
Yes, I'm just curious I'm curious because I'm not following the argument. And it's not your fault. It's mine.
In this case, the problem is that there are multiple theories of liability within the definition of consent itself. So correcting that statute is the ultimate problem. That's why it's facially unconstitutional to begin with.
But let's assume we disagree with you on the facially unconstitutional aspect, and now we're just examining how this instruction works to make it that he's not — it's unconstitutional as applied to him.
Yes, Your Honor. This instruction that we provided earlier, I read to Judge Johnson, looks at distinguishing incapable versus capable of consenting evidence, and that removes parts of the uncharged theories of liability from the definition of consent. In this case, there's no such correction. This case has a due process violation in it because sleep is a different theory of liability than without consent. Chief Judge Olson, your questions about sleep and incapacity, these are similar. Sleep is an incapacity theory of liability. A person who is drugged, who becomes unconscious, that can be charged under a sleep or unconscious theory of liability, which we know from Sager is multiple theories of liability in itself, or it could be charged as incapable of consenting due to drugs. Congress wrote this statute with multiple theories of liability specifically enumerated in it. By circumventing the mens rea requirement in incapacity cases, A1C Casillas and similar situated accused are not on notice of what the theory of liability to defend against is. This is clear in this case alone because of the instructions that A1C Casillas asked for at the beginning. He thought this case was about intoxication that was blacked out. There was nothing about sleep at the origin of this case, and this case evolved into sleep. There is a due process violation in this case. The instruction, if this court holds that sleep is a different theory of liability than without consent, which it is in light of Peace, Riggins, Sager, Mendoza doesn't stand on an island. These cases all support that this is a different theory of liability. This case has an instruction that says a sleeping or unconscious or incompetent person cannot consent, and then a panel member asked, what does incompetent mean? And then the definition under G8 was given. This panel convicted on an incapacity theory of liability. And that's why, if this court finds this conviction legally sufficient and does not remand for factual sufficiency, A1C Casillas is entitled to a new hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:30.
Court stands in recess until 10:30.